Hey everyone, it's Ariel Helwani.
And I'm Chuck Mindenhall.
And I'm PT Carroll, and together we are 3-Pack.
Join us on the brand new Spotify Live app immediately after all of the biggest fights in combat sports.
And also during the weigh-ins, because that's when the real drama happens.
So what are you waiting for? Follow the Ringer MMA show right now on our exclusive Spotify podcast feed.
And come join the best community in MMA.
Peace! We're out of here.
I have a secret.
Uh-huh.
I use Secret Whole Body Deodorant because more than just my armpits stink.
Oh, can I use it where my bra rubs under my...
Oh, yeah.
And what about down there? You know, my...
Totally. 4 out of 5 gynecologists would recommend it. So I tried it, and now I get 72 hours of freshness from my pits to my...
Ooh, I love that it's a spray.
Me too. And it comes in sticks and creams too. Go get your Secret Whole Body Deodorant.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line, he owes me a huge karmic payment. It's Andy Greenwald!
And people make fun of me for bringing my backpack with me from room to room. You never know who's going in your stuff.
Andy, it's great to see you, man. I hope a West Ham fan didn't steal your phone over the weekend. We are going to be talking about the season finale of season 2 of White Lotus, which aired last night. I want to get into the nuts and bolts of the episode, and then I also want to talk big picture, kind of like what White Lotus and its success this season tells us about TVRN right now. I saw you over the weekend, but it's still lovely to see your visage right now.
This is great, and it's, you know, it's always nice to have a guest on the podcast. And by that, I mean Brian Tyree Henry, whose presence is always welcome on television episodes, more than once where he's not on. But it's, you know, it's just us again. It's just us.
You made reference to our year-end TV podcast that we do annually with Sam Esmail. And we want to say thank you so much to Sam, who will never be invited back on the pod.
Worried about that.
Sam's welcome. Sam could do multiple times per year. I may not do all of them. But if Sam just wanted an outlet for his takes, he could have him in The Watch.
We love Sam. I do feel bad. I didn't tell him we were done recording. I just backed out. I believe he's still there at Spotify HQ.
That's right. Hey, so speaking of our year-end pod, you on your top 10 list had White Lotus Season 2 as your number 8 show of the year. So I thought we would start here. Did the finale improve White Lotus's standing? Did it drop or did it stay the same?
It's a great question. I have to say, like, as a parenthetical, post revealing our lists and having a robust conversation about them with Sam, I am more anti-list than I was last week, if only because I understand the reason for the exercise and the fun that can come from it. But like, communicating to people that just because Severance was our 11th favorite show of the year doesn't mean we hate it is really exhausting to me at the moment. So
it's funny you should say that, because I went the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Because something happened to me over the course of that podcast. As many people may have noted, I got a little fired up. And often I'm like, I would like to think of myself as either, some would say non-confrontational, but others might say agreeable, you know? So somebody has an opinion and I just am like, that's cool. That's your opinion, you know? And
that's why you thrive at Twitter.
I didn't mind Sam yelling at me about, say, Atlanta season 3 or whatever. But what I did mind is, like, when Sam would explain his rationale for his picks, I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me, you know? So it's really actually, like, reawakened in me. It's like, I don't actually think the list is the thing. I think it should be that you have to then defend the list with logic that, like, actually tracks across the entire 10 shows, you know? And that's basically impossible.
No, I mean, I think that Sam's argument that House of the Dragon was good because he had friends over every week and they all enjoyed it
but we
is,
were
is a strong argument.
But we were basically like the people from the beginning of WALL-E because we were like, sometimes we like watching slow war scenes.
By the way, I really treasure both what you just said and the fact that you referenced a Pixar movie. Did you watch that with my daughter also?
No, I saw the first. I like to give Pixar movies like an opening 10 minutes because, you know, like that's where all the powerful stuff is, you know.
To be clear, the obese pod people don't show up till like 30 minutes into WALL-E.
Okay.
The first 30 minutes, they're just on the dust planet picking flowers and dust and going, Eva, like that. That's the whole 30 minutes. It's great stuff. Look, let me stay focused. What I wanted to say was the finale absolutely bolstered the White Lotus's case for excellence and to be very high on mine or maybe even anyone's list of best TV shows of the year. I think that if I was going to get like ticky-tack about it, get into it, does it jump We Own the City? Probably. The reasons for that are less to do with the excellence of the sticking of the landing of the finale and more about just my admiration for the project as an ongoing project. And again, as we say about We Own the City, of everything else on the list, that feels more siloed to me. It's just absolute excellence from an excellence factory, from Simon Pelicanos Incorporated. And they make, this may have been in some ways their most succinct and greatest argument for what it is that they do, but it does not feel connected to the larger cultural conversation in a way that I wish it did, but it doesn't. So I think that the finale, to answer your question in the shortest way possible, which is the way I always avoid, bolstered the case, without question.
Right.
I was so impressed by this finale, both as an entertainment product, but also as just a statement of Mike White's artistic intent and his ability to execute on that. You know, this show is greeted and obsessed over like a mystery box, which adds to the fun. And one of the most fun things about these last few weeks has been everyone, and I know it's a small sample size, but many people in our lives and beyond talking about it and watching it and enjoying it together. You and I love that. We always talk about that. But the show is not a mystery. It is, as you know, revealed in this episode, kind of a satirical tragedy. And I love the commitment to being what it is, despite the trappings of other things that draw eyeballs, that draw attention, that draw clicks. It was so true to itself in the end. And I found that really impressive, especially with kind of the word bravery gets thrown around a lot, but like, I can't believe he did it, honestly.
Yeah, that was what I came away from this episode with, is just a sense of Mike White's is a real one. Because think about this guy's career. I think that he has been widely or at least passionately respected. Let's put it that way. He's been passionately respected by a niche audience. He was sort of a writer's writer, a critic's fave, but had not experienced like a ton of commercial success, at least like that we knew of. And maybe he's rewritten some stuff or...
No, like School of Rock, but
School of Rock, but like in his TV outings, especially with Enlightened, which I think was a very painful experience for him because it meant so much to him and he had this star vehicle for one of his favorite performers in Laura Dern. And it's got a very devoted cult following, but did not ever catch on as like a massive hit show. Not the way White Lotus has. And so now he gets that. Now he finds himself making one of the truly like talked about shows of the year and of the last couple of years. And maybe one of the only actual authentic success stories to come out of the COVID production changes that hit television. And he gets to the end of season two. And what does he do? He kills his darling. You know, he kills what I thought was his muse on this show. And then when you watch the after the show, kind of the post HBO wrap up with him, he's kind of delighted by it. He's kind of delighted by Tanya's death and finds it kind of amusing and has this sort of sick, dark sense of humor, which I think is definitely in the DNA. It's in the bloodstream of this show. And it actually is like an essential part of it. But I was so happy, kind of, not because I was like, yes, Jennifer Coolidge, no longer, but like, because I was like, this is a guy who could easily be making season six of White Lotus, Where Does Tanya Wind Up Now? And probably 75-80% of the people watching this episode would be along for the ride. And I probably would be too. And then instead, he's like, that's not the world view that this show has.
It was, I'm going to say it, fuck it. It is an incredibly brave artistic choice. And it was absolutely rewarded, and we'll talk about the specifics of the scene. One thing that carried over this entire experience of the second season was, quite simply, what is The White Lotus as an ongoing show? We talked about this, I think, a little bit last week as well. And there were a lot of possibilities, most of them decent to good, if not great. And the version of it where it's a, you know, we swan around the world with Jennifer Coolidge as our tour guide, basically, that's a hit show. That's fine. Nobody's mad about that, you know? When we saw the, when the season began with Bodies, I was like, okay, he's found a formula. When he was on, and I know you're going to drag me for it, but this Fresh Air interview was really good. When he's on with Terry Gross and he's talking about the importance of Fantasy Island to him as a kid, you know, and the kind of TV Sam hates, where it's just like wrapped up every week and started over again. Like, there are worse things to use as your totems, as your inspiration. You can still do good work within the boundaries of something like that. But that's not what he's interested in. It's just not. And it's interesting. It's an interesting comment on, I think, how all of us have, and not necessarily a negative one, have kind of absorbed TV, not just as what's on our screen, but the experience of it, the creators. We pay attention to what's going on behind the scenes, what it means, the working relationships, et cetera, work-life balance, you know? And you could say, well, Mike White has found this success where not only can he make something good that people like, but he can travel the world with his good friend. Because mm-hmm. that's also been the subtext, right? Is that he and Jennifer Coolidge are very close, and he sees something in her that maybe others missed, and so he's given her these showcases and these opportunities. Who begrudges someone for like going to luxury properties with their pals on HBO's dime?
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
But he respects her, and he respects the audience, and he respects the opportunity to make something so much that he's like, no, I'm not just going to coast here. I'm going to take someone that I love and a character that I love and give them the ultimate showcase, which means treating them fully without kid gloves or without any emergency handbrakes, right? And this was, to my mind, she won an Emmy last year. This is exponentially a more interesting and better performance.
Oh, yeah.
And the path that it took, what it meant for the show, what it meant for him, what it meant for her as a character and an actor, pretty unparalleled. And like, and it was surprising. You know, I said at the beginning, it's not a mystery box, but This was surprising, or maybe I don't know. Maybe I'm mixing up the words. Maybe shocking and not surprising, but it really was something that took me aback.
Yeah, I think that we can talk a little bit about how the mystery boxing of this show sort of subsumed or took over the discourse around it after a while. But I think it's like, you know, you basically have to like keep people coming back, right? You have mm-hmm. to leave the breadcrumb trail now. And I found that where this breadcrumb trail led was by far the most interesting use of that tactic that we've seen in recent memory. So is like you basically like coach people into, they must sit down at 9 p.m. wherever they are mm-hmm. and watch this show as it happens, because something could happen and they don't want to get it spoiled, or they want to be able to start talking about it as soon as possible. But that's just the Trojan horse to put in all this stuff about the transactional nature of sex, or how to really be happy in your life, or like what it is to, you know, all these questions that Mike White's obviously more interested in than a murder mystery in Italy. Although he's obviously quite good at telling a murder mystery in Italy.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing, is I think he actually got way better at doing the genre stuff, or at least threw himself into the genre stuff in the second season as compared to the first season, where it was almost like in the first season there was a body bag and it was like, eh, I just did this for HBO and now here's this show.
Again, like in interviews, he's very upfront about the fact that like he figured people would be interested if there was a body. Like it's not cynical, it's actually just kind of smart business, you know. He gets that and it works, so why wouldn't he continue to do it? But I agree with the substance of what you're saying, which is I think he was more inspired and excited by it here. And I think it was clearly influenced by the setting too. And you know, Italian cinema. And Sam mentioned Antonioni and Fellini. Like these are things that he's watched and he knows. And what's interesting about him though, and I think it's not unique, but it's rare in creators, is that he's very comfortable being the writer that he is and letting that kind of seep into or ooze into other genres, but never really straying from what it is that he does and never being self-conscious about that. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is the entire Tanya Quentin plot is not complicated. It is not full of twists and turns and surprises. It seems too good to be true. And then it is. And we see the flash of darkness in Quentin almost, you know, as soon as they get to Palermo. We've known that something was cooking since episode 5. When she goes into, and I was referencing it at the beginning, as Nicola or Nicolo's bag.
Nicolo's, yeah.
And it's literally a bag from a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah, it's like the clue pieces. It's like a candlestick, some rope. Yeah.
Yes, like a bear trap. I mean, what else could be in there? I mean, she finds the props for the murder of an heiress. I mean, she is, in a way, all of it is performance, which is part of it. But the emotional devastation and inevitability of it and the way it tracks to the type of humor that he has, the type of story that compels him. I guess what I want to say is it's really impressive and inspiring that it's just what he wanted to do and he stayed true to it. So that at the end, it is, it's surprising. It's violent in a way the show hasn't been. It goes to some unexpected places. But when she's pointing the now emptied gun at Quentin, who is drowning in his own blood on the floor of a yacht he can't pay for, and she says, "Is Greg cheating on me?" That's everything, right?
Yeah.
It's horrifying and human and cringe and true. And that's what this whole show has been building to. And he pulled it off. He pulled it off with aplomb and style. And we all watched it like it was a murder mystery, but it wasn't.
Yeah. And I thought that the best part about it, the best part about the episode in general was what wasn't said and what wasn't explained and what wasn't on screen. So let's talk about some of these unsolved mysteries. For one thing, Quentin does not have a last gasp expository speech about meeting Greg, fly fishing on acid, having some kind of, illicit affair, or maybe he's just got a long-standing candle for this guy that's never burned out. He doesn't talk about the mechanics of their plot against her. He doesn't talk about how Greg has always felt like she was using him and now he was using her, or that she had always wanted, she was never going to be happy with him, so he wanted to. There was never any explanation. Just the same way, there's no explanation of whether or not Ethan and Daphne consummated a relationship while they went on that little walk to Bella Isla or like whatever it was. And we also never really get deeply into the psychology of Lucia and her con, I guess, of Albie. You know, like she never says like, well, I really would like to go back to Los Angeles with Albie, or this is the one time where I've really liked a guy that I've been with, but this is ultimate. No, I mean, they go traipsing off. Like, as I know in Fresh Air, he based Lucia and Mia on Laverne and Shirley. They go traipsing off like the title sequence for Laverne and Shirley at the end, you know, like that's all left there for us to kind of fill in the blanks. And there are so many moments in this episode. My favorite being probably when the three generations of DeGrasso men ogle a woman as she walks by. And it was almost like Albie had just himself kind of settled into the transactional nature of sexual relationships and kind of accepted, well, you get what you pay for. And if I pay for it, I get to just turn and look at a woman. Like, you know, you can see these people get corroded and corrupted. And I thought that the fact that he didn't fill out every word of it was quite brilliant.
It's really a testament to his ability as a writer to get a large swath of the American television viewing public to not only sign off on, but you know, give an enormously high approval rating to a show where no lessons are learned. You know, I'm trying to figure out, like, what did these people figure out? What have they learned? And I think what's amazing is, again, you know, the spirit of what I was saying last week about a show made by people who've gone to therapy and are kind of frustrated by it. Like, they've seen things. They've seen things in themselves that maybe surprised them or, you know, made them uncomfortable. But what are they going to do about it? Vacation's over, you know, back to the real world. And you think about, before we get into the other stuff, because I think you could make an argument that, like, there wasn't room for some of those things, and you know, for more of a punctuation mark on the end of those other plots sentences. But the thing about the Tanya story that's really worth circling back to, I think, even before we get to the other characters, is she got everything she wanted right up to the very end.
Well, I think that's the point of what is happening. in Palermo and on that boat is that in some ways, to my read of it, was Greg and Quentin cook up this plot, but that the way they either they make themselves feel okay about it or the idea for it is that we're going to give this woman everything she's ever wanted.
Yes, we're going to, I mean, as she says, another amazing thing about the show is Mike White's operating strategy for dialogue seems to be Michelle Obama's when people show you who they are, believe them. Like, everyone says who they are.
Right.
We don't listen or we squint or we see it through someone else's prism or lens. Or she says to Portia, right, like, everyone is just always dressing me up as a doll. And then they let her live La Dolce Vita.
Right.
You know, she's so happy with them in a way that we haven't seen this character be because they are celebrating her. They celebrate who she is, her quirks, her bright colors, her interest in substances, whatever. You know, yeah, to your point, like it's a celebration of her right up until the very end. That's chewy. That's sticky. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Right. And it also helps because you could look at this and do something that I think is not productive, which is, wait, what was their plan? Why was their plan? Her husband, who seemed like a nice guy for two episodes, shows up and then lures her to Sicily for this very extravagant murder by yacht. I mean, it's ridiculous, but it is tonally appropriate, A, for the, you know, the sort of when you're on vacation, when you're in Sicily, rich indulgence of the season, it tracks. But more importantly, you stay with the character and you see what's being done to her and you feel all of the things that you're meant to feel.
Yeah, I thought that Tanya's plot and Albie's plot, mm-hmm. both were kind of about, if it feels good, does it matter that you're paying for it? Mm-hmm. You know, and for Tanya, it was like, if it feels good to be the center of attention, to finally be worshipped, to finally be taken seriously and to be paid attention to, does it matter that it could cost you your life? And for Albie, if it feels good to feel virile and sexually wanted and important and not like this kind of beta who Portia pushes around and probably has happened in other relationships, does it matter that you're paying for it? And in some ways, I guess that also applies to people like Harper, where it's like, in the end, she finally rekindled Ethan's sexual interest in her, but had to drive him to the point of a breakdown. And obviously, I think it may be into the arms of another woman. So she in a sense, pays for it, you know, like in that sense.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about those guys.
Yeah, because I found that at the end of the show, I think if you could make any, not complaints, but if you were going to like just throw some critiques up on a whiteboard, one would be that I found Ethan's character to be almost so blank that I didn't really know how to feel about it, but like what really was going on behind his eyes, you know, like did
yes
his sort of like, you know, increasing like sense of mania about Harper's infidelity and his conviction that she's done this, which I guess turns out to be right. And then he goes off with Daphne. It was like a little bit of like feeling around in the dark for me there. How did you feel about that?
Well, again, I think one of the great triumphs of the scaffolding of the show is that Mike White could make a story about four people, and not really move the needle too much. Have it kind of just sort of boil or simmer and simmer and simmer and then end the season because there were highs and lows around it. You know, so just in terms of like the orchestra, that was really well done because you can't make that show be its own thing. Mm-hmm. Because the lesson of it, which I found really profound and not something I've seen on TV so much, is everything is choices. There is no larger karmic scale of restorative justice in emotional and interpersonal relations. You know, the fight that Ethan and Harper have where he's just like, but I didn't do anything wrong. Mm-hmm. He thinks that entitles him to something. And her opinion is, so what? Because to her, in her internal scale of justice, that didn't matter. The greater sin.
Yeah. And his negligence is a
greater
crime.
Thing.
Yeah.
And those value systems are never going to be aligned, which is low-key one of the interesting things about those two couples all season, right? Because at the beginning of the season, Harper is turning to Ethan being like, we're not like them because we have morals and we read newspapers. But what the season revealed was that they are all in these very fraught balancing acts, but only one couple is enjoying it. Mm-hmm. And that's a choice. And it was almost, it's interesting. The moment when they get up from the dinner table and join them was, to me, one of the most masterful things of the season, almost underappreciated. And by me, I think even by audiences with so many other things going on, I'd like to rewatch that scene because so much is in it. You know, as they're sitting down to dinner, I'm watching the show and I'm like, first of all, I can't believe they're still at this fucking restaurant. Like just once. You know what I mean?
Once more to the breach, baby.
It's just insane.
Bring out the linguine and vongole.
I was like, I can't believe they're going to eat together again after everything that's happened on this day. And then they're not. And then what Cameron and Daphne teach them is almost the abiding creed of their existence, which is you fake it till you make it.
Right.
They are choosing to say this was a good experience. This was a good trip. And by the end, I believe by their behavior in bed and afterwards, Ethan and Harper agree. They're like, we can hold on to this, these resentments and these angers and these things about how things should be. You don't do that. But clearly you do these things. People do these things. You can do them. And you can then choose to be okay with it or not. But you can't, well, I guess you can, many people do. But the one thing that maybe isn't the best outcome is to choose to kind of participate in it, but be angry and resentful about it, like someone's making you do it. And yeah. I think by the end of that meal, they're like, this wine is good. These vongole, it's been consistently good for the last 8 nights of dinner.
Are we sure it's not the vongole from Monday? It could be.
It's unclear. I would be interested in the specials board at the White Lotus Rest. Like, do they, you know, does Chef have like Taco Tuesdays? Does he keep it moving?
Well, that was one of the things that was funny about this season is that, you know, the first season is much more about these sort of spoiled guests who are very much paying to be waited on hand and foot and made to feel special by the staff. And so much so that the Murray Bartlett character essentially goes crazy doing it. And then this season is much more about these guests wanting to feel important in the eyes of their partners or in the eyes of their, you know, loved. Like it's a little bit more, the transactional nature of these relationships moves from like the sort of employee-employer kind of dynamic to the lover dynamic, which I thought was pretty savvy on White's part. You know, another savvy thing he did was he cast this show impeccably. It's only 7 hours about, you know, give or take, maybe 7:45 after you add up all the other stuff that's in it. And I feel like I've been living with these characters for seasons. And one of the reasons why is because I think once you get used to the way certain performers have their rhythms, the Ethan Harper casting, especially the Will Sharp, Aubrey Plaza casting, it's like, that just feels like a real couple. That feels like a real couple of like kind of very flat affects. You know, she's flat, but has like a little bit of like some porcupine needles to her. And then Ethan is very much like, everything is kind of a poker face for him. And you never really know how he's feeling about a situation until he explodes. And I just have to say, I mean, like, and then contrast that with Megan Fahey and Theo James, who, even though we never really find out if they've brought Harper and Ethan on this trip because they're trying to get money or because they actually just don't really have any friends. And this is like, we can only travel with people as rich as us because you don't want to get into a situation where like certain people can't afford stuff. I thought like the contrast between those two sets of casting was great.
I think that I ultimately, again, this is so hard to pull off. I love that I don't care about the Cameron and Daphne reasoning. You know, I think because what they did do is they turned them. They have turned Harper and Ethan into
them
or a version of them or people that they can actually, I don't know if get along with, because they seem to be able to get along with anyone, but that they can understand by the end. So it's an incredible turn. Like the money part, the professional part becomes irrelevant, right? And I thought it was a really nice, as we always say, Mike White is very, 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 very aware of what people are tracking, even as he's writing it. Like, I think he really relishes dangling chads, if you will, to a degree that doesn't feel manipulative. It feels celebratory. So I think he was aware that people would be clocking, does Cameron even have money? Is that what this show is about? Does it matter in the end? No, but he does pay Lucia, you know, which then, whether it's the reason why she ghosts on Albie or not, it reminds the audience, whether it reminds her or not, we don't know, that this is transactional.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you thought two things. I had two unanswered questions around that, which is, one is, do you think that Cameron paying Lucia changed the calculus as to whether or not she was going to go to LA with Albie or if that was ever even in cards. Did you think that that was, that there was a causal thing there, a cause and effect there?
I don't know if I have an answer in terms of the character. I think its placement in the show suggests yes, and is important for that, you know, mm-hmm. that especially she's paid and she's happy and she turns to Mia, who's achieved what she wants too. And it all works out for them.
Yeah, you know, so, it does. It does. And it, I mean, because she has that crisis, literally a crisis of faith earlier in the season where she's just like, this is bad. Like, we're doing bad stuff here. We shouldn't be doing this. And then Mia kind of turns. And I think that Lucia is like, what have I done? And then she meets Albie and off screen concocts this. Alessio is going to be my fake pimp who's going to like con this guy.
But is it fake?
Yeah, he's like a doorman at a hotel. He's like a lovely, like he seems like a lovely little guy.
That's who that was. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I wanted to track that.
I think that was all a con. That like him following them and smoking and being like the rough pimp is like completely fiction.
I thought that was what's happening, but I was not tracking it.
But I wonder whether or not earlier in the season, she's like, this is a mug's game, like waiting on these guys to go to the bank to cough up euros.
Yeah.
Is a losing proposition. But then at the end of the season, she's like, holy shit, like this pimp thing works and this guy paid me and I walk out of here with what, 63,000 euros or whatever.
But also isn't romance a mug's game? I mean, I think that's the other piece of it, you know, like
Albie being like, I'm going to take this woman back to Los Angeles with me is a mug's game.
Literally everything on this season that appears too good to be true is too good to be true.
Yeah.
Whether it's, you know, Tanya being celebrated by the high-end / murderous gays, whether it's Portia
finding the one soccer hooligan who's gonna like keep it together and show her a good time in Palermo or in Sicily.
But also it's you know, the Tanya storyline isn't exactly subtle, but the small things that we're not going to spend a lot of time focusing on, right? Like you referred before to the Albie and Portia dynamic, and like we know from early on in the season by episode 2, Portia's like, whether she says it or not, she's like, I have bad instincts when it comes to men, you know, mm-hmm. or when it comes to relationships. It doesn't mean she should be attracted to Albie.
Based on her clothing choices, she might just have bad instincts.
The clothing really is triumphant. And there were some articles written about the design, and especially with the Gen Z character. Like, I loved it. I think that's just an unsung hero of the show is the wardrobe department. But you know, like the show exists in a place of nuance that a lot of shows just aren't afforded the opportunity to get to, whether they're able to or not, whether the creators can even pull it off. Like, Albie is a better choice for her than the fucking lunatic, Jack, but mm-hmm. the heart wants what it wants, as a great filmmaker who we don't talk about anymore once said, right? Like, that's what the show exists in, that and allows that to be the case.
Is that like Michael Cimino, who are you talking about?
It was Michael Cimino, yeah. He wanted to keep spending on Heaven's Gate, from what I understand. I wanted to...
I have one more unanswered question I wanted to
throw at you. Okay, because I did want to go back to Ethan and Harper, but let's do unanswered.
Good job, because I want to know whether you thought that Ethan and Daphne slept together.
I love that we don't know. Mm-hmm. I feel what was interesting to me about that scene, and again, if you're doing stealth MVPs of the season, Megan Fahey is maybe number one. I loved her performance throughout. And she does a thing in these scenes like that. She basically gives the same speech twice, right? Mm-hmm. She gives the speech to Harper where she shows the picture of her kid who may actually be the son of her trainer. And she says it essentially again, which is you have to find a way not to be the victim in the story. And when you make that decision, it's easier.
Mm-hmm.
It's literally easier. That's money makes things easy, but actually choosing...
She's modeling... How to like enjoy life no matter what's underneath the hood. She's like, I want a massage. Yes. I want to go to the island. I want to do this. Like she wants to go to Nodo and get drunk with a friend. And it doesn't matter if it winds up setting off all this stuff in motion. And I think that, you know, that in it, you can take a step back from the Harper, Ethan, Megan, Harper, Ethan, Daphne, Cameron storyline and be like, there's almost a mythical quality to what Cameron and Daphne extract from Ethan and Harper. They're almost like their guides through another world, you know, the underworld.
And this is the thing that I love about this entire arc. She's not wrong. Now, do I condone mass infidelity? Do I condone mass online donations to cute bunny charities when you're drunk
honestly,
at night?
We, on this podcast, we don't. We don't.
We don't.
No.
This is a very
this is a podcast
Catholic
for,
podcast.
For monogamy, yeah.
and hot Carrie Lake takes. That's just what we do. What we,
those two things are not
service.
Related at all, but
no,
okay.
Apparently not. It's just like when people try to pin us down, you know what I mean?
That's right.
What did he say? My pronouns are prosecute Fauci?
That's what Elon Musk said, yes.
Yeah, sure. You can't tell with that guy. Keeps you guessing. Love it. So good faith, all of it. No.
Why do you act like you're not on Twitter? You had that pulled out so quick. You really are not on Twitter.
I told you yesterday, every Sunday, I open the app to read people talk about how good the Eagles are because it fills me with happiness.
Okay.
And when you open the app, it's generally a reply guy whom I follow, quote tweeting Trump or Elon Musk, being like, not so, sir. You know, so that's how I learn about the issues of the day.
Okay. Ethan and Daphne.
Is the reply guy you? Maybe.
It's not. Maybe. No, it's not.
On your burner.
All I do is reply to Carrie Lake, like, yes, queen, keep serving this diffused look.
That is also accurate. I think that Daphne is really onto something in the sense, as someone who has an experience, you know, like many people, like has a relationship with anxiety or whose mind can cause problems or obsess over problems that might not actually have happened yet. You know, you remove yourself from the present and you park yourself in some future catastrophe because that feels more familiar or more manageable. It can be, you can work on that. Like that is change that you can do where you can be present in it. Now, would I perform my life the way she does? Unclear. But I think that what's interesting about her is, like with many of the characters on the show, is that they are kind of flawed avatars for interesting points of view that come up either in therapy or in actual adult life. Did something happen? I think it became mythical at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I think she took him to an oracle, essentially. She showed him something, you know, and whether it was just the content of what she said to him or whether they had some sexual experience on this island, the result is the same.
Right.
He learned something about how to be in the world that was not working for
him.
Yeah,
he has that weird grin for like basically the rest of the episode.
Yeah, he learned something. And I am a big fan, when used correctly and sparingly, of the glowing briefcase in Pulp Fiction, which essentially that's what this was. You know,
right.
There is something more than this that causes human behavior. And you could say there are 100 solutions. There are 100 possibilities or hypotheses as to what it is. Now, behind all this, I think you said at the beginning, like Ethan was a pretty blank character. And I think that I think the performance is really cool and really interesting. And I'd love to see him. I can't wait to see him in other things I'd never seen.
And you can get away with that in an ensemble, especially one where you've got Haley Lou Richardson and the Italians and F. Murray Abraham and
yes.
Jennifer Coolidge.
Bigger performers.
Going for it in a big way. You can have like also a
yes.
muted corner of the show. And then his sort of unraveling over the course of the season, I thought was very effective. You know what I mean? Like this is a guy you can kind of imagine him being really fastidious. If he's doing something in tech or in software or whatever, like, you know, if he's coding, a lot of this stuff is like ones and zeros to him. And mm-hmm. if he's like, I didn't do anything, but I know that you did.
Yeah.
So I am morally like justified in demanding a reckoning here. That's like, it really made sense to me, even though they never really got into a side speech where Harper tells Daphne, well, Ethan's this coder and he sees everything in binary. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
I mean
you don't have to say that.
You don't have to say that. Could you make the case that I would have liked a little more about like what makes him tick or not what makes him tick, what he does and maybe about their relationship.
Maybe I don't want the Vongoli every night. You know what I'm saying?
That's all I'm saying. But if you go down that path and you consider, you know, in the way you would if you were in a writer's room or if you were Mike White, like, there's not a ton of real estate. It's a very busy ensemble with a lot of different things to, you know, to give time to and attend to and explore. The broad strokes are that he's kind of incel-y, right? Like that there's a element of him that could go in that direction. He was slightly bullied and introverted.
Right. And has and everybody he's ever expressed a romantic interest in, not everybody, but during college, he would express interest in a woman and Cameron would just go and sleep with him.
And he's furious. There's anger. Mm-hmm. And there's anger and resentment about all of his circumstance because he is essentially coding his way out of it, just as he is performing his own physicality in a different way. He is, you know, he's super jacked and ripped. He runs every day. He's transformed himself and he's transformed his circumstance financially as well, and hasn't really advanced beyond his reasons for doing that, right? Like, it was kind of, it's clearly all a fuck you. But what do you keep saying fuck you when you've plateaued? Like, he did it.
Mm-hmm.
So then what? And I think there was some meat on the bone, as Jalen Hurts likes to say after another dominant win, like in terms of the attraction stuff, like why does he, I mean, porn is porn, but like, does he feel deserving of a different type, archetype of partner or wife or multiple, that does he feel deserving of that? You know what I mean? Did he want to be with Lucia and Mia that night? But he insists that he's better than that. Like, all of that, you could say you want more of it, but as I'm saying it, I'm like, it was there.
Right.
On a rewatch, it's probably all there. And the other thing that Mike White does really well that is to all of our benefit is not just the casting, but the partnerships, the scene partnerships. Aubrey Plaza is a very specific performer. So who you pair her with has to work, and it has to work and build over time so that when they have the scene, the confrontation scene, you're buying both of them. You know, you're believing the lived-in nature of it, and that her quirks and peaks and valleys line up with his in a way. And I thought we really saw that in this. You know, I wonder how much of that is also, it's casting, but it's also all these people really are living in Sicily together. Do you read the interview with Adam DeMarco, who plays Albie, where he's just like...
Yeah, no, Phoebe did like a whole thing. She interviewed Aubrey Plaza for GQ, and Aubrey was like playing like these sort of long-term pranks on Adam DeMarco.
Did you see Adam DeMarco had never seen The Godfather?
Yeah, I did. That was good.
That's cute.
Yeah.
What did you, speaking of him in that storyline, I mean, there's a version of this where the DeGrasso plotline, nothing happened.
Right? I mean,
like they arrived and then they left, which maybe is the point.
It's interesting. It's hard to say. I'd like to take each one of these sort of little micro storylines and then say, here's what this was about. And in some ways, I think that the DeGrasso's was about like sort of like having their illusions wiped away. Like, obviously Bert thinks they're going to go back and that this connection with their homeland is going to somehow enrich or save a life of perhaps, you know, not great behavior by him, you know, that like connecting to this like far flung part of his family will redeem the fact that he's probably broken the family that he had, you know, in America. And for Albie, it's the illusion that he's the guy in, you know, that the sex worker with a heart of gold is actually going to fall for.
And that he broke the curse of the family. He's enlightened. He's different.
And then for Dom, I'm not really sure what it is. Maybe it's that, like, you know, for him, I think he's in purgatory this entire time. He's like serving time and needs to come out one way or the other on the other side, and kind of, I guess, by just standing steady throughout this entire season after the early trespasses, thinks that he's like, he's under the illusion that he has like sort of served his penance.
I mean, let's talk about that. I think what's cool and why we love and why everyone loves, especially people with podcasts, love talking about the show is that it can be multiple things at once and it's open to interpretation. There's an argument to be made that no one was more underserved this season than Michael Imperioli and that character. That, to your point, he began with a head full of steam and other things and then settled into Dante's Purgatorio for the remainder of the season. And he was either playing his anger up towards F. Murray Abraham or his disappointment and condescension down towards Albie. You could then take another step in a different direction and be like, that's part of the sneaky triumph of the show, that the plight of the incredibly rich and successful philandering white man is not necessarily the main A story of the show the way it was the A story of the last 20 years of prestige television, and that because $50,000 means nothing to him except as a karmic payment, he doesn't need to learn.
The
Nothing
rich guy
needs
wearing
to change.
Cool sunglasses is no longer the main character.
And he's fundamentally uninteresting because he doesn't have to change because he can use his status and his power and his money to bend reality to accept him back. He hasn't changed. He hasn't learned anything. He's seen some things. If he suffered anything, it's some indignity or embarrassment in the eyes of his son, which does matter to him, but it doesn't matter to him enough to see beyond the short-term gain of like, you'll make things good with your mother for me based on nothing other than what Albie wants. I mean, so that's kind of what I love about the show. Like hidden in, it's not just that he hides, you know, the things that interest him character-wise or emotionally within a murder mystery and he gets away with it, Trojan horsing it. He's doing a lot of other things too that I think are significant. Like having a character just sort of settle into purgatory for the majority of the season and leaving us with that. Yeah. You're not supposed to do that. That flouts all note giving. It flouts all television structure advising. It doesn't make sense, but it lands because there's so many other planes in the air.
Let's talk a little bit before we get to some sort of macro lessons that this show taught us this season. Let's talk a little bit about the Italians, like, right? Let's talk a little bit about Valentina and Lucia and Mia. For Valentina, she also learns like that happiness can be bought to some extent as well, right? That these trade-offs that you can make in life. She starts this season repressed, I think very much like has a lot of her guard up all the time. And then over the course of the season, learns to use her power in a non-petty way. Like usually it's just like rearranging who's going to stand next to Isabella at the front desk. That's right. That's her name.
Yeah.
And then she sort of accepts her kind of, I am the director. That's what she says to Giuseppe. She's like, I am the director here and I can call security. And this is who I want to have singing and playing piano. And she's like, yeah, like I can have this girlfriend for a night and then these girls are going to hook me up with some Palermo lesbians or whatever, and we'll just get it rocking from there. What did you think of the sort of conclusion of that plot line?
To me, interestingly, as you're asking it, Valentina and Ethan are similar.
Yeah.
Your moral outrage and unhappiness is a choice. She's much happier at the end.
Yeah.
Because she's not fighting it, you know? And to her credit, like, everything Mia does in the back half of the season is transactional.
Is the lesson of the show that people need to get laid?
I think Mike White would say yes.
Yeah.
I think that's a strong argument. I'm okay, so what are we for? What's our platform on this podcast? Sex positive.
Counting every vote.
Counting every election integrity.
Yeah.
Those are our hallmarks. Yeah, I mean, I guess I wanted, like, everything Mia does is transactional. She gets what she most wants. But she's not mean about it. You know what I mean? It's a little mean when she double doses Giuseppe, but that wasn't intentional. The Valentina thing was so interesting because she's just like, that was great. You're really cool. I had a nice time. I should introduce you to some proper lesbians.
Yeah.
And Valentina's like, okay. And then she gets her job from that. I don't feel like that was a con. You know, I kind of like the different layers of it on the show where people use pressure points to get what they want, but I don't have a moral judgment about that. That seemed to be fine. And it was surprising. That was an example where season two zagged from season one when we were introduced to a kind of harried manager of the resort, right? I think that was a worthwhile change from what expectations may have been at the start of the season.
I only had one other thing that I wanted to throw at you about the sort of scene-to-scene work that happened in the finale, and that is that this was an episode that I thought showed the totality of Mike White's grasp of filmmaking and storytelling, because I have to admit, again, my wife Phoebe and I really did it up last night. We made like a lemon ricotta pasta.
Look at you.
We popped like a sparkling white that had like some tangerine over like notes to it. It was really quite nice.
Would you characterize me as a sparkling white? Sometimes. Not always. Sometimes a little flat.
It took us basically 2 hours to get through this episode between the pausing and the chatting and stuff like that. And I think part of it was that, like, there were some real nail bite, white knuckle moments in this episode, no more so than the Jack Porsche stuff, which I thought was just fucking awesome and breathtaking. And really, like, you know, I saw a bunch of Rembert our buddy Rembert, especially being like, I can't believe she waited until she gets in the car to start asking all these questions.
Yeah.
But I was like, damn, I don't like when he takes her to the outside of the airport in Catania. I was like, this is an incredible place for this to end. And I thought that the kid, is that Leo Woodall is the name of the guy Jack?
Yeah.
What a fucking fine that guy is. You know, yeah. I mean, I know that he is basically like, I'm from Essex, and I feel like he's going to be in stuff for a while now. And I thought he was dynamite. I thought Haley Richardson did a great job completely filling out every part of, mm-hmm. of Portia. And I was like legitimately like, this is a great thriller during those scenes.
Do you know when actors are interviewed, even sometimes when we interview actors, and something that almost always comes up is, did you fill in a backstory?
Yeah, right.
Or did the director or writer give you the backstory so you could play the scene? And the answers are vary. Sometimes people are like, yes.
They've been asking White Lotus folks about this, yes. Especially in Vulture. They've been like, oh yeah, well, like Valentine, the woman playing Valentina said, yes. Like, Mike did not give me a lot. Will right. Sharp seemed to have like a lot about Ethan though.
So every actor is different. Some people want things, some people don't. Every writer is different. Some people love to load people. I mean, there's no one way to get to it. The reason I bring it up is I rarely think about any of that when I'm engaging and watching something. And the moment in the car when Portia says, so you fuck your uncle? What Leo Woodall does in that moment with his face and with his emotion and with his body, especially in comparison to the person that he's been for her and for us, all I was thinking about was he knows everything that happened. And it doesn't actually, you know, I want to be clear. I don't mean that like he had like a PowerPoint presentation of the events of Jack's life. I just mean his body remembers. You know, that there's that trauma book, like Body Keeps the Score.
Sure.
That's what I thought of in that scene. It was such an amazing performance and moment.
Top five trauma book for me.
Is it? Did you seek solace in it after the disappointing events of the election this year in Arizona, in your home state, your adopted home state? I thought that was just wild. And the attention the show does pay to class and employment dynamics too. You know, there's a version of it where Portia like becomes a hero, right? And like gets the carabinieri and they have hydrofoils out to the yacht and they yeah. rescue Tanya. But this show doesn't exist in that world. The show exists in a world where
self-preservation.
Working for Tanya is weird and fucked up.
Yeah.
Bad shit, like catastrophically bad, you will be written about in TMZ and there will be a Lifetime movie made about you in 10 years shit, doesn't really happen. You can't move through your life expecting it. So she gets on the airplane, right?
Yeah, I mean, knows. She knows when Albie says there was a shootout on the boat and there's dead bodies in the water. I mean, she's like, that's Tanya. She knows.
But it wasn't her Italian tragedy. It wasn't her story. She wasn't supposed to be there. She wasn't supposed to leave her room, right? And so, again, like there's just these little moments that sprinkled throughout that where, you know, it's Tanya's, is Greg cheating on me while Quentin's coughing up blood? It's Portia finding out what happened to people and then saying, can I get your number?
Right.
You know, life goes on and sometimes life's kind of trite. It's just wild. By the way, speaking of life going on, Maldives next season?
No.
Was that an intentional reference?
My brother, we are going to Japan apparently.
Who says?
Mike White says they're going to Asia. And Kaya was like, I think they're shooting in Japan.
Okay, so I predicted, not on the microphone, Kaya, so it doesn't matter.
I predicted
Asia.
Kaya, are you going on the record with that?
This is like from what I've seen on an Instagram account I follow called Dumois. So like not super strong on the record.
Hell yeah. Way to go, Kaya. Way to get in the streets. Get the shoe leather going.
Anon, please, Kaya. Come on, pretending we don't know about that. We're not that old.
Excuse me.
So
the reports are, okay, so Mike White hints at Asia set season 3 focused on, quote, death and Eastern religion.
Yeah.
Asia would feel like the inevitable choice. I thought the reference to where they might go next was baked in intentionally.
Yeah, and to be fair, he did actually say, he said a little bit about, like, he teased the idea of basically continuing some of the storylines. So I don't know whether or not like anybody from season 2 will show up or, you know, I mean,
I'm sure that they will. I feel like that's interesting to him. I thought like a place like Bali would make sense in terms of the, like, yeah. the occasionally uncomfortable overlap between the performance of Eastern cultures and Western tourists and all of that. But look, he knows what he's doing
wherever
he chooses.
If Mike White will stay in Michael Mann's Tokyo apartment that he used to make Tokyo Vice.
Maybe they could get a lease together under the name Michael White Man.
I believe that's the person who's just put up a deposition for Carrie Lake.
I think that's right. I think that's right. So
I have to wrap up. I had I thought we could have this conversation, okay, which is essentially Lessons of the Lotus.
Mm.
So we just got through 7 weeks, two delightful months, basically, of talking about this show. This show has reached, I think, heights beyond even the wildest expectations of HBO, but maybe I'm wrong. I think that it has become a legitimate sensation in the incredibly small bubble that we exist in. You and I were at a gathering on Saturday night, and it was honestly the number one conversation topic. I feel like you would walk into a kitchen and, you know, people were talking about it, and then you'd walk outside and people were talking about it. So big old hit.
Rembrandt overalls or
but it was a big old hit. Let's just put it that way for HBO. So I thought we could come up with some lessons of the Lotus. Number one lesson for me, Sunday nights matter. They still matter. There's still nothing like it, at least for our purposes. There is nothing like the anticipation that comes with people being excited for a show that ends the weekend and starts the week, that slots right in so that the next day you can go in and just be like, Jesus Christ, you guys see that? What do you think is going to happen next?
Yep.
And, you know, we've sort of experienced so many different versions of this, whether it's 1899 going up all at once, whether it's Andor going up three at first and then 1111, but then also going on FX. We've had so many different kinds of release models over that have emerged out of COVID and now have become standard. But there really is nothing like Sunday night, 9 o'clock. Your stories are on, and this is the one that sort of transcends almost all watching behavior. I feel like some people like to have these things built up so that they can binge them, and some people like to watch Mandalorian at 6 a.m. on Wednesdays. But I don't know a single person who's like, I'm not so into Sunday nights hanging out and watching TV.
Also, shows about adult humans matter. I'm not relitigating House of the Dragon. I think there's room for big monocultural genre things up and down the board, and there should be. But there was something extra about this, right? That like people were watching it for a lot of different reasons, not to find out, you know, who the dragon eats this week or whatever, or who washes up on the shore, but because they saw pieces of themselves, maybe pieces of themselves they don't like, or other people that they know. There were a lot of different ways in, which felt really good. And I think the other part of it that was surprising to me in a good way, the approval, this is all conversational, this is anecdotal, but people seem to really like the season. People seem to really like liking this season and the show. It hasn't reached a point where people don't seem to be hate watching it. They didn't seem to be watching it with an expectation that, oh, I hope we achieve the heights of the Connie Britton storyline in the first season. People were ready with these people and engaged with it on its own terms, in a way that felt kind of rare, right? It did not feel to me, maybe after the first or second week, to be constantly looking backwards, like people were comparing it.
Right.
That's pretty rare too. You know, second years of things, you can see diminishing results, even if those results are still at a benchmark that's successful for everyone involved to get you a third season. This feels like it's opening up and growing. And then you get this punctuation mark at the end of the season that's like, nope, it's not just going to be what you thought it was. We're going to draw blood, even though we're an ongoing series now.
Yeah.
Remarkable. And I didn't even answer your question. Sunday nights matter.
Yeah.
It matters. 1899. Guys, I'm still watching it, but do I feel the sense of fun or urgency in watching? I mean, it's not a very fun show. Even when I like it, it's not a very fun show. But it does feel a little diffuse, you know, just to be checking in with my homies on the ship. They are on the ship, right, Chris?
They're
absolutely.
Totally.
It's a nautical adventure from what
I understand. One hundo on that ship. Okay, so lesson number one, Sundays still matter. Lesson number two from Andy is adults matter, and having like shows where people can see something of themselves or their experiences that matters. This is the one that I was most interested to get your thoughts on, is all shows are mysteries now, question mark. So You kind of touched on this a little bit about the idea of drawing blood, and I just thought I would throw this in there. I don't like praising one show at the expense of another, and God knows that you won't find very many bigger Succession fans than me. But I did think that these two shows were both like dramedies that got subsumed by the mystery box conversation around them in some ways in terms of the discourse. And I thought that that probably benefited those shows, Succession and White Lotus, for in terms of like week-to-week audience, and especially probably if you miss the first one or second one and then you get caught up with it and then you're part of the, you know, the avalanche of speculation and people are breaking down, you know, the art in the hotel and what dress Tanya is wearing and how it's the same dress as Apollonia and Godfather and all this stuff. And a lot of that same kind of Easter egg hunting and deep textual analysis happened with Succession last season. And it was really about like what's going to happen and what's going to happen and what's going to happen. And then as you got towards the end of the season of Succession, and this is, I guess, a spoiler for Succession, but there's that pregnant pause of a week where everybody is wondering whether or not Kendall is dead. I was incredibly excited about the idea of Kendall Roy dying, even though he's my favorite character on that show, because I thought it would have been brave and I thought it would have been a logical conclusion for that character. It was interesting to go through the Tanya experience. I don't know that I feel as like deeply invested in Tanya as I do in Kendall Roy, but that's what it feels like when nothing's sacred. And yeah. I think that if shows are going to commit themselves to being mystery in name only, or everything but a mystery, but still a mystery, or whatever you want to call this sort of phenomenon of turning adult dramedies into Lost, then I think that the creators need to have a trigger finger and be willing to get rid of stuff, because you got to feed the beast when you start to get into this, to this kind of industry.
The White Lotus is the perfect show for this moment. Almost, you'd think it was designed in a lab or a focus group, but it was just suggested by one person during a pandemic, which makes it even more incredible and probably makes it feel more vibrant and alive and worthwhile. But like, it is the answer to a question that hasn't really been, it can't really be consolidated into a single question, but it is an industry-wide wondering of like, how do we make TV in this moment? It's a question that also touches the, wait, it's an ongoing now, but it's winning in limited series. What is it? It's both. It's both. It's almost unique in that it starts new every year. It's new settings, new cast, new opportunities. You can rebrand, you can reboot, you can get that marketing push that does matter. I mean, I remember this from conversations when I was on the other side of the ball, that like, it's in some ways easier to break through with something new. It's hard to sustain, of course, but that is, there's value from the marketing department on that. You get all of that, but you also get some continuing DNA like the classic TV shows, you know? So it's remarkable for that. This is a bigger conversation maybe to be have, and maybe it's the conversation that we have on the pod when we're not talking election integrity, which is, and it's in some ways related to what Sam came in with hot last week when he started the you know, talking about TV regressing.
Yeah.
Maybe there are essentially three eras of television. There was all of TV until, I don't know, The Sopranos, right? Which is just like, we're just going to keep churning it out.
This might be biased around our lifespans, but yes.
Sure. Yeah, but I also don't think Sergeant Bilko broke the mold. You know what I mean? I think we could talk about Love American Style and fold it in comfortably into this conversation.
It is funny, though, how you'll be like, there's all of TV up until The Sopranos and like all the shows where like 51 million people were watching.
Yeah, no, we were talking about this with Sam off mic. Like Cheers and MASH and Twin Peaks, like, these things matter to me. It's hard to compare them. But one of the reasons it's hard to compare them, but to the present day, is at a certain point, all shows did become Lost. Not in the way that we watch them, but the idea that shows or pilots need to be motivated by a question, and that the work of the series will be answering the question. Not in a Reddit theory way, but like, who's going to succeed Logan Roy?
Yeah.
That's a question.
Yeah.
Now, what's different, though, and is worth putting, maybe I don't know what the exact moment where things broke in this direction would be. We could talk about it maybe on another pod. But like The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Mad Men did not start with a central question. You could sort of fudge it with Breaking Bad and be like, well, how did he end up as Scarface? But he didn't. It didn't start with a flashback. It didn't start with, this guy is the drug lord of New Mexico, but now he's a teacher. Huh? If you were pitching it today, it would.
Yeah.
Those three shows start the way every show did for 30 years, which is, here's a situation. Let's hang out for a while and we'll see what comes of it and see what happens. Those shows don't get made anymore.
Yeah.
They don't. Even the shows that, the reason Succession is a good thing to talk about is that Succession in some ways is the most normal of our leading contenders for best drama series every year, but it has a central question that motivates it, that fuels it, and that will ultimately end it in a way that, you know, Northern Exposure didn't end when
maybe
it was less exposed.
I mean, West Wing went on beyond Jed Bartlett's presidency.
West Wing wasn't a question. West Wing was like, hey, here's a guy who's president now and the people who work for him. Okay, what's next week? You know, it just, ER was, here's a hospital. The questions come up with terms of character arcs or plot points, but those shows were vessels that were built to the star of, we've done this before, the star of ER was the hospital. The star of the West Wing was the West Wing.
Yeah.
And Rob Lowe, but the West Wing.
Right. And then maybe the star of White Lotus is the hotel. But I think that the fact that maybe what felt like I'll put a body in a coffin at the start just to kind of like get people interested the first season. The second season, I thought it was much more leaning into the idea of like there was a, you know, and it's no accident that this thing, you know, the volcano going off the entire episode.
We didn't even talk about that. Beautiful.
Mount Etna, which is also where Talented Mr. Ripley is set. Like this was much more of a Hitchcockian kind of like murder in a foreign land kind of story. And I wonder whether season three Mike White's a very interesting cat. Like his interviews at the end of season one were very, very, very provocative, I thought, in terms of like both his kind of creative vision for the show and his awareness of how people were watching it. I haven't seen those yet. You know, this season, they didn't send screeners out. There wasn't like a bundle of Mike White
for the finale.
And there wasn't like a ready, like there wasn't already done Mike White interviews that dropped at 10:01 on last night. So we'll see what he says about the show going forward. But I wonder whether or not he'll be like, this isn't a mystery. Like, I don't want to make a whodunit every season. What this is about is putting people in what's supposed to be the most comfortable positions, but wind up being the most uncomfortable positions.
I also got to say, he's just not built like the auteurs of previous shows or generations. You know, he doesn't, maybe it'll be different when his interviews drop today or next week or whatever. But, you know, like when Matt Weiner would do interviews about Mad Men, which, you know, I am not criticizing that show, which is almost total perfection for me. And I don't begrudge his willingness to do this, but his interviews would be like, well, the state of American manhood in the 20th century was this. Yep. Like he ran towards the larger significance and context and wanted to be on that, at that lectern, having a say, having a stake, making a comment. And I think Mike White, especially in these interviews, it's partly effect. I mean, he's a performer too, you know, but I think it also seems very genuine where he's just like, you know, I like kitchen sink dramas from Broadway because I read those and they felt classy to me. And I like probably Patricia Highsmith novels, but I also like Survivor and Fantasy Island. And I have some friends with interesting personality quirks. And I took a trip with my dad once.
Yeah.
You know, I really think that one of the things that sustains and will sustain the success of the show is his humility about it. He's like, you know, I have an opportunity now in an audience and it's so fun to have that.
Right.
But what interests me still interests me. And I just love that about the second season. I did think the first season tried to wrap its arms around some really big things and have something to say about them. And this season didn't shy away from big, big things, but I don't think it, I mean, that's kind of a straw man argument. It was not a didactic season of television, you know, but this one just kept circling back into the kind of mushy middle of the people, which is really, really the kind of drama I like. And is really, really hard to do on TV in any era, but particularly in this overheated, how are we, you know, what questions are we solving? Who did it? What's going on era?
Yeah. And I thought that, you know, he obviously knew what he was doing because the set dressing, the not Easter eggs, but like there was grist for the mill for people to analyze, like, okay, what's the myth about this statue? Why is this head in the room? Why is this painting of St. Margarita like on the wall? Like, why is, you know, the things that he was doing in that regard, I thought really did propel the conversation. It'll be interesting to see if he does that again next season. The last lesson I had from this show, which isn't unique to this show, but is a lesson done this just the same. And we haven't really mentioned this person's name that much in this pod today is how desperately and how necessary it is for shows, be it a show in its fourth season, be it a show, it's a limited series, is that somewhere in the course of the season, there needs to be a gear shift. And the gear shift in White Lotus season two is Tom Hollander. It really brought a sense of A, romance, B, mystery, and C, fun to the season that I didn't know that it had necessarily with just Tanya and being on the back of a Vespa. And it made me realize, like, you manage these things like a bullpen, you know, and you can bring an arm out to change the game if you want to. And I would love to see more shows do this. Like, I think sometimes you can see the kind of like, this person has been hired for a 3-episode arc. Yeah. Or I've also seen, frankly, you're not going to really care, but on Yellowstone, they've made a lot of mistakes where they've been. Yellowstone's made some mistakes where they're like, John Dutton has a vegan girlfriend now. You know, and it's like, this is really not working, you know, and I don't really know like how much longer you can sustain this, but, or how long Piper Perabo's contract is for, but this is now kind of getting in the way of what is already like a show that seems to be a little bit aimless. Yeah. Like, I think that Mike's ability to say 3 episodes and then we're going to bring in a fireballer at the 3rd or 4th episode. He did it with Molly Shannon. He did it with Tom Hollander. And it's just like an absolutely, just a perfect maestro way of controlling the orchestra.
But I love that observation. I also think it's relevant to what we were just saying about how to straddle the eras of television, because I think that bringing in someone to change the game, like that's a hallmark of long-running, serialized or not, shows. Like I remember when Justified was out and then Margot Martindale comes on the show and everyone's like, oh my God, this is a totally different thing now thanks to her. Or, you know, what was really good about that was Damages. You know, like, guess who's doing this now? Oh, yeah. Ted Danson's here. Wasn't Forrest Whitaker on the show? Like they would just call in these heavy, heavy hitters or big free agent signings to come wreck shop and change the show that had maybe, it hadn't even grown stale, but the perception that for another year, which is another year.
I think Andor had that by the changing of the settings and like you get to,
exactly.
It's like fucking Andy Serkis is here. This is like a completely different vibe.
So what I mean is bringing that energy, making even short games, bullpen games. I mean, it's White Lotus season two. It's 7 episodes. You have however many credited casts from jump, 9 people. Tom Hollander doesn't show up until what, 3 or 4?
Well, it's really only 6 episodes if you take out all the shots of water.
That's fair. That's fair. I feel the same way about 1899, because that also is a show set on water from everything that I'm understanding from the discourse. But you know what I mean? Like bringing that, that's a pretty exciting, chaotic disruption to bring to the limited series space. Because usually I think, you know, again, you're always looking for a way to switch it up, to surprise people. And I think that we have settled into like, okay, 6-episode limited series, look who they got for this. Like Fleischman's in trouble. It's like, okay, we got Eisenberg, we got Kaplan, we got Danes. They're on the poster. We're good. You know, we don't need to start scouting the waiver wire in episode 3.
Right.
But it's a really good observation for how to keep people entertained and to just not settle.
Yeah.
Even within something that is relatively limited.
We can wrap it up there. I thought it was a great season of television.
So fun.
Yeah. That was really fun talking about it this season. Andy and I will be back on Thursday. I think we're going to talk about The English, because that is a show that wound up on Andy's top 10, kind of out of nowhere. I mean, you know, really without much discussion on this pod. And I've since caught up and I got a lot to say about it. So if you don't know what that is the Emily Blunt Western that's on Amazon Prime. Comes from Hugo Blick, who did one of our favorite shows of the last 10 years, Honorable Woman. And really excited to chat about that. Really unique and inventive show.
It is really worthwhile. You may not like it. You may love it. It's beautiful. It's confounding. It's surprising. It's really worthwhile. And I think people should check it out. All the episodes are on Amazon now.
So we're going to chat about that. We're also going to get really deep into finding out whether or not Henry Cavill's coming back as Superman, Andy.
Dying to know.
I got reporters on the ground in 4 different countries trying to figure it out. Thank you to Kaya McMullen for producing us today. We will be back on Thursday. Hope everybody enjoyed the season of White Lotus, and we'll talk to you again.
Michael White Man versus Black Adam. That's all. I've just been tweeting that at James Gunn.
Forensics.
Yeah. But we're not ready to have that conversation. Okay.
Bye.